This meeting is now being recorded.
Good evening all. My name is Aaron Meikle, Senior Extension Manager with Beef and Lamb New Zealand. I'm the host for this Red Meat Profit Partnership call tonight, Thursday the 4th of February 2016. So look, we won't muck around. We had a call, same call last night, on the same topic, the same speaker for farmers, and we had a heap of questions. So we want to get to those as quick as we can. We've had quite a few come in. Feel free to send more in during the call via email or via text, and we'll get to them as soon as we can, and if we don't run out of time. Your lines are all muted, so feel free to make a cuppa, get the kids off the bed or anything like that you need to do. It won't disturb us, but we are recording the call as well. You may have heard that get turned on, and that'll be available down the track. So if you don't quite pick up something tonight, you'll be able to re-listen to the call. And when we send that out with an email, we'll have a few links and links to documents and so on that we may have mentioned tonight. So last night I introduced our speaker saying we've got her over here to talk about drought feeding, and it worked perfectly because as soon as we arranged the visit it started raining around the country, but now the game's over I can probably let you know that she's actually here to follow the Australian cricket team around the country and do some work while she's at it. So I can make that joke tonight. We don't get to make jokes about beating the Australians at cricket very often, so we'll make the most of it while we can. Sam Jolly is somebody I met a couple of years back when we were in South Australia and was highly recommended over there as a stock nutritionist. So as part of the Red Meat Profit Partnership projects that our six meat processor partners are working on, we've had Sam over here talking to some farmer groups, and today we're at Lincoln University talking to them about some of their dry land research. So we thought we'd get her on the call while she's here. Obviously, the initial topic was thinking around feeding in a drought or feeding a large amount of supplements, but Anne's got a wide amount of experience in general stock feeding. So we're going to get on to the moment, but I'll hand over to Sam now to do a wee bit of an introduction about herself, her business, what she does day to day, and then we might move into just a bit of her observations so far on her comprehensive tour of New Zealand over the last 4 days. So welcome to the call, Sam.
Thanks very much, Aaron. Hi, everybody. I've had a great time. Started off up in Hawke's Bay on Monday and Tuesday. Very interesting looking at some plantain clover pastures up there, irrigated and non-irrigated. And very kindly, James Aitken had tested them for us. And so then we spent the next day with that RMPP group and Progressive Meats out in the paddock, trying to get the farmers to guess what the feed value was. And then all was revealed with the feed test. So that was very revealing and lots of fun and a pretty informative day. As soon as I got off the plane, I could see that I really didn't need to be spending a lot of time talking about drought feeding. And I've really just followed what people have been interested in and what they've wanted to know. And as it's turned out, I've probably spent most of the week talking and emphasising feed quality. I think New Zealanders are very adept at pasture management and rotations and assessing dry matter availability. But certainly in the spots that I've been to date, there doesn't seem to be a lot of work or a lot of understanding going on or measurement about quality. And before you can make any decisions about cost-effective supplementary feeding, you really need to know what you're starting with. And so quality measures are pretty critical. And just a little bit of background on me. I've been doing this sort of work now for about 20 years. I predominantly work one-on-one with farmers on an annual basis and develop farm plans with them. A lot of my clients are mixed farmers, so we tend to look at gross margin per hectare and paddock use and try and determine which is the most economic balance of crop and livestock and pasture. And that's all good fun and very exciting. And I also do a lot of training workshops, always by invitation and always custom designed to meet the needs of the group. So that's pretty much what I do. And I predominantly consult in South Australia, Tasmania and Victoria. So it's great to be here. Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Ian. So we started off last night and it actually tied in with a lot of the questions that were coming. Do you want to talk just about some of the things you've observed or you've been perhaps telling the farmers over the last few days when you were up in the Hawke's Bay around You talked about what you do with the feed test, but what are some of the things you're stressing to them about that?
Well, the feed test kind of underpinned it because at the moment, of course, all the hills pastures are, there's a bit of green germination now following the rain, but there's a lot of dry feed up over the hills. But on the flats, you know, it looks terrific. These plantain clover pastures look $1 million comparatively. But of course, all the perennials at the moment are trying to go reproductive. And so they're, even though they look green and terrific, they're actually quite low, relatively low in feed value. And so what you'd be expecting to see now is not accelerated growth, but you'd expect to start seeing a drop off in growth rate. And quite a lot of the farmers have been asking about that. One of the other things we've been talking about are trying to select the right species for the job that you're trying to do. If you're looking to just cruise lambs at this time of the year, having got the first draft off, and then hoping that, you know, the prices will start to increase as time goes on, and getting some accelerated growth at that time, that's one thing. But if you're looking for accelerated growth now, then your choice of pasture is pretty critical, and you're going to get much higher growth rates on your rapes and those sorts of things, now your forage brassicas, than you will on your perennials, which, you know, are not very high in feed value now at all. So we've been having quite a lot of discussion about selecting the right species. It's very easy for us. In Australia, grain is relatively cheap, particularly in South Australia. The further west you go, the cheaper grain is. And, you know, it kind of stops us having to think too hard because we can just throw grain in there and easily fix problems. Whereas here, you've got the rainfall to be far cleverer with your choice of pasture species. So we've spent a bit of time talking about that.
One of the things, and you touched on it today when we were out at Lincoln looking at the pastures, is measuring ME is important, but NDF and protein are a couple of things you really stress. Do you want to just expand a wee bit on why and what, you know, the audience tonight are a lot of people who might be advising other farmers, what they want to get their farmers to look for?
Yep, so it's one thing to know how much dry matter is in the paddock. It's another thing to go and look up what your particular weight of lamb at the required growth rate needs in terms of protein and energy. But it, in some ways it really doesn't matter how much feed's available. It's the NDF, the neutral detergent fiber, that actually determines how much that lamb can eat. It's a very useful little equation that was developed by Peter Van Cerf in the US many, many years ago. And there are some skeptics about it in Australia, and no doubt there are here too, but there's plenty of evidence to support that it's a very, very useful measure of estimating intake. And of course, as NDF goes up, as the fibre concentration in the plant goes up, it's not always something that you can see. If you get like a 10% increase in NDF, you get a significant reduction in intake. And considering that it's both the grams of protein per day and the megajoules of energy per day that are driving productivity, then how much of that feed that's available the animal can physically eat in a day is a critical driver of performance.
The next question, I'll go straight into this question that came in, is around using more information than just ME or kilograms of dry matter. What do you recommend for people out there who may be advising farmers as a source of information for helping make decisions and formulate diets? So the question's pointing out that New Zealand's beef industry is moving to incorporate more than just pasture. There's various forage crops coming in, but we're starting to see a bit more use of concentrates as we've seen animals move on to hill country or higher and drier country. Specialist crops like lucerne and others, fodder beet coming in. How can advisors get good information, either published or software tools or something like that, to help them make the use of that information and put it all together for their clients?
It very much depends on, and I don't mean this, you know, it sounds a bit weird, but it very much depends on the ability of the person who's giving the advice, really. If you're pretty slick at Excel, then you can easily put together an Excel spreadsheet which incorporates dry matter, NDF, ME and protein, and put in your feed test, and then use the NDF estimation to work out intake, and then calculate how many grams of protein and ME, et cetera, that the animal's going to be getting given that intake. If you also then test the grain and put that feed value in as well in the spreadsheet, then you can start playing around with, okay, well, you know, if I put in 150 grams, 200 grams, 300 grams, you know, am I getting close to the target of how much total protein and ME that I need? So it really depends on your level of knowledge and understanding of nutrition as to how confident you feel doing that. Alternatively, look, there's a myriad of programs out there. Some are good, some are bad. But what I would suggest is that whatever program you use to formulate a diet, that it's kind of an imperative to get the producer to monitor growth rate. You must monitor your growth response. I tend to use the nutrient recommendations from NRC, NRC 2007. It does require some conversion from American units, but they are the most extensive for sheep. And my experience with them now over quite a few years is that if you only use the recommendations for early maturing lambs, they're pretty good. They're pretty close to the mark in their ewe recommendations. They're pretty good. But when you get down to the very light end of the lambs, they're not so accurate. So as I said a minute ago, you really do need to make sure that the producers are monitoring growth rate when you make recommendations about supplementary feeding, such that they are getting an economic response.
NRC 2007, that's a published book out of...
Yeah, if you Google NRC 2007, then, yeah, you will get there. It's quite a large book, and you can order it from, you know, places like Amazon, or, you know, you can access some of them. I've got a funny feeling that you can actually only access the goat requirements online. Otherwise, you probably have to buy the book. But it's been my Bible for about 20 years, and it mostly works pretty well.
Okay, good. You're talking there about to make sure that the calculations work and measure the animal response.
Mm.
For input into these models and calculations, mm-hmm. and we have some benchmark figures for feed tests for supplements, for concentrates, barley and the like. I mean,
mm-hmm.
how much variation do you see when you actually test supplements, hard feeds from some of the book values? Is it worth doing?
Yeah, absolutely it's worth doing. And it depends a little bit on what you're testing. Across the cereal grains, we don't find much variation in ME from oats to barley to trip to wheat. All of those cereal grains are around about 13.2 to 13.8 ME megajoules per kilo. And that doesn't vary much at all. However, I am not familiar with the varieties that you're growing here. I don't know if those varieties have been bred here or if any of the Australian varieties have come in, but we have enormous breeding programs, and you know, I've done thousands of tests, and so I'm fairly confident in that lack of variability. But we were talking the other day about the benefit of oats. You know, a lot of our farmers are now going back to oats. They're going away from barley, trit and wheat because oats doesn't kill anything and it's much easier to introduce it quickly. But the ME can be more variable in oats than it is in barley, triticale and wheat. Your proteins don't vary a huge amount in wheat, but it kind of depends on the wheat that you're using. It depends on what its purpose was that it was grown for. Is it a feed wheat? Is it a bread wheat? You know, that in itself will inherently result in different levels of protein. So my sort of rule of thumb, if you ever want to get on top of nutrition, is just don't waste your time and money guessing. Just get it tested.
So just on that, that's actually questions just come in, but it's sort of... it ties in with what we're talking about there. What's the, I'll just pull this one up, your recommended program for getting stock on the grain and transitioning onto them, training lambs, I guess, to use it, or new style imprint of foot, or how do you, what do you, most of your farmers do who use it a lot?
Look, it varies. It varies on the system that you've got. One of the challenges that you've got in high rainfall areas, and I'll just clarify that by saying that I come from a 500 mil rainfall area, and I have clients between 200 and about 12 to 1300. And so to me, you know, 6 to 700 would fall into a medium to high rainfall. I just clarify that just in case that's not the case for you. But yeah, I mean, where you get significant, sorry, I've gone off the question now. To clarify
getting ewes and lambs onto grain onto it, safely, training animals to eat grain.
So ideally you would imprint them on the ewe, but often at that time of the year, you've still got green feed, you know, when you're weaning your lambs. And so it's actually quite difficult. They're not driven to eat grain. And even if the ewes are, because once the ewes are trained to grain, they'll never forget it in their entire life. But the lambs are not so driven to it. So yes, that's the ideal, if you can train them onto it. But otherwise, you've just got to trail it out in circular trails and start at 50 grams a day and just watch the outliers. Just make sure that everybody's coming to the grain and take them up by 50 grams a day for the first week, then double it to 100 for the next week, and then go up to 150 for another 5 days, and then up to 200. It's kind of that period from 0 to 200 that you need to be careful. Once they're on 200 grams a day for a week or so, then that's given them sufficient time for the rumen bacterial populations to adjust such that they've got plenty of grain-digesting bacteria there. And if you are going up higher than 200 grams, then you can go a bit faster. But if you're going on to self-feeders with barley, triticale or wheat, then you need to get them up to at least 400 to 500 grams a day before you put them onto self-feeders, because some of them will sit there and just lick until they die.
Thanks, Sam. So we'll move on. The single most popular question that's come in from both farmers, rural professionals, advisors, and I think you heard it when you were up in the North Island visiting farmers, and we touched on it a wee bit today when we were out at Lincoln. What's the value of roughage to ruminants on lush green pasture? Ryegrass and white clover or green grass, you know, which most New Zealand's animal intake still is, what's the benefit of actually putting something such as roughage with them?
I tend to preface everything I say by it depends, and it does depend. It kind of depends on what it is that's driving the scouring. If the feed is really full of water, which generally in winter it is, if you think about, if you had a kilo of feed, if you visualise that kind of in a container and it's only about 10% dry matter, which is where all the nutrients are, that other 900 grams of water has to go somewhere. And those animals are trying to get in as much green feed as they can to meet their dry matter intake requirement. And so, of course, some of that water will be excreted via the kidneys. But a lot of it will just go straight through the rumen, through the system, and out the other end. So in some ways, it's very important that, you know, we don't kind of block them up and slow down the rate of passage too much. But that's what the fibre will do. It will slow down the rate of passage. So the key to not losing productivity is to make sure that the quality and the palatability of that roughage is good, so it's not just some old rubbishy straw that, you know, you might have got somebody from somebody cheap, or ryegrass straw, or, you know, something fairly unpalatable. Because the problem with straws in particular is that they are low in energy. And so the more of that straw that the animals eat, the lower the energy concentration of their total diet goes. So if you've tested the pasture and you found out how much ME is in it, and it's about around about what those animals need on a daily basis, then you'd be loath to dilute it down too much. Now, if you're testing something like a forage brassica, which, you know, is often up around 12, 13 ME, well, then you've got some energy to play with. So if you were to put out some hay which was, you know, 8.5 ME, then that would be okay because, yeah, as I just said, you've got some energy to spare. But we need to be monitoring growth rates to actually find out how much of a problem that water is. I mean, I've had steers growing out on forage brassicas where, you know, it's a pretty untidy sight with water flying out the back end. And we've put hay out there, and those steers were ripping along at, you know, 1.5 to 1.8 kilos a day, and it didn't make any difference. So if it's not a problem, then don't fix it. But on the other hand, if you've got a problem with a pasture that is excessively high in protein, so for any of you that might be opportunistically grazing cereals in the winter to fill winter feed gaps, or if you're grazing brassicas in the winter, some of those plants in the winter can be excessively high in protein, up between, you know, 30 to 40%. And you will get scours as a result of those high volumes of ammonia in the rumen. And so in combination with, you know, increased rate of passage with water. And in that situation, putting some fibre out there can be incredibly beneficial. So hence I say it depends. There's not just one answer.
Well, let's stick on that. Our most obvious candidate for a very high protein level in intake is lucerne. Mm. We talked about grazing pure lucerne sports today. Mm. Is there a benefit to putting in an energy source in that case of grain? When would you see a response? How would you go about doing it?
Okay, so once again, honestly, at the risk of being boring, I can't emphasise it enough. The place to start is get a feed test, because you don't know what you're dealing with by looking at it. You know, is it 28% protein? Is it 38% protein? So the first thing to do is get that test. The next thing to do is look at the ME. So if the ME, like at the moment with lucerne, it's down around, you know, 8.5 to 9 right now. It's not very high because the plants are going reproductive. Then you will get a response if you put an energy supplement in there. And I'm talking about a high energy supplement, you know, like cereal grain at 13.5 ME. You will get a response in growth rate. But if the ME of the lucerne is meeting requirements, if it's up around 10.5 ME, then it's unlikely that you'll get any response. So the place to start is always have a look at how the base feed that you've got, how far in deficit is it from what that animal requires.
Shouldn't you also be looking at the protein level? You know, you were talking about the level, even if it's high EMA, but if it's excessively high, 40% protein, you may still get an issue and require some energy.
Yeah, that's right. And then the question is, well, what's going to give you the most cost-effective response? Fibre in terms of, you know, trying to dilute down and mop up a bit of protein, or ME in terms of grain. So then it just, you know, it comes down to what's the most cost effective and what's easier for you to manage.
So we got onto this last night. I might just bring that question in here. If you are putting grain into a diet on lucerne, what's your thoughts on what's the best one on cereals?
Absolutely oats. But I have to clarify that with saying that you know, we have had a massive export oat and hay, oat breeding industry going in Australia for quite some time, and we've now got some incredible varieties of oats which are highly productive and really, really high quality grains. So I don't have that knowledge about oat varieties in New Zealand. So for those of you that are giving advice to farmers, it'd be a good idea to either get that information from the labs if they've got it, or start doing some testing. So, yeah, ideally oats, because rapid introduction, you're not going to kill anything, you're not looking for protein as a general rule, and oats are usually your lowest protein grain. So they're kind of a really good fit, and they're often more fibrous than your other grains too.
Right, well, I'm going to repeat a question that actually came in last night. Marked a few other questions, and I think it's of general interest. And as you've already touched on, New Zealand's still based on grazing in situ, grass or forage crops, but we are seeing around the margins opportunities for, you know, can we improve performance with supplements? And palm kernel expeller, PKE, is obviously a major one in the dairy industry. The question that came in last night was an interesting one and started a bit of discussion. For recently weaned merino ewes on tussock country, how much PKE is too much?
Interesting. So with all byproducts, if you don't know anything about them, then the safest rule of thumb is to never feed them at more than 20% of the total diet. Most of your byproducts will contain something undesirable, and there's a fair range. In terms of PKE, the biggest problems with it are, as a rule, it's copper. High levels of copper, normally about 23, 25 ppm, and that's okay for merinos. So provided merinos aren't getting copper poured in from some other unknown source, then they'll tolerate that much. So it's very unusual to bowl merinos over with that level. So you can feed them more quite safely. But what we do know is that Texels and Suffolks have much, much lower tolerance to copper. I haven't seen any published work on any other breeds of sheep. But we do know that their tolerance is only down around 5 ppm. And above that level, there's a significant risk of copper accumulation and liver damage, irreversible liver damage. So if you feed it, if you keep it restricted to 20% of their total diet, you shouldn't get into trouble.
What about for cattle? Any different recommendations around PKE for cattle?
No, I'd say exactly the same. And the other thing too is we've got to remember that PKE is also putting some protein into the diet. So once again, if you're not looking for protein, if it's not deficient, so for example, grazing lucerne, then you don't need it. So it's not always just about cost and availability. If you're looking always for a cost-effective response, then it's important to be using the right supplement, not just the one that happens to, you know, be down the road.
I had some feedback after the call last night from a person who actually asked that question. He said he thought he was pushing it at 5% of intake, so he wasn't quite prepared to go to 20%. Hey, salt's another one that comes in. We're talking about additives and supplements and so on. I think Sam's made it pretty clear that good green grass is about as good as we can get, and we're not certainly pushing that New Zealand farmers should go to a high input system. We've had a bit of conversation over the last day or two about the risks of that, but there's always needs must in a drought or just to fine-tune performance, perhaps on a block. The salt blocks are one that always come up here about either salt itself is an important nutrient, the animals need it, and they certainly eat it and lick at it, obviously, and as a way of delivering nutrients or trace elements and minerals, rather. The question here was around young cattle on Kikuyu-based pasture. Is there any advantage or in any particular time of year? But maybe if you answer that question, expand a wee bit on the role of salt in nutrition. Does it actually play a part?
Yeah, there's nothing specific about Kikuyu pasture that I'm aware of, particularly in Australia anyway, that would require the addition of salt to the diet. It was interesting listening to Derek Moot today down at Lincoln saying that, you know, in his opinion in New Zealand, that that lucerne is a very poor uptaker of salt, and that he recommends feeding salt when animals are grazing lucerne. I have to say that I haven't found that in Australia, but then we're in New Zealand, and what's relevant here is relevant here. When grazing cereals, wheat is inherently salt deficient, and you definitely need to supplement with salt. Otherwise, salt's actually a very interesting product. It works as an intake stimulator, as we all know. You know, how addicted do you get to chips? And but if you take in too much of it, you can kind of sit there and draw the law of diminishing returns curve, in that initially it will stimulate intake, but when a certain level is reached in an animal, then it actually puts them off eating. And that's why when you're trying to deliver urea in a safe form, salt blocks are about the best way of delivering it, because, you know, sheep just won't, or cattle won't stand there and lick it until they fall over from urea toxicity, even at really high concentrations, because that amount of salt intake will start to put them off eating it. So it's pretty useful. The other thing that salt will do is it increases the rate of passage, the emptying rate, you know, out of the rumen. And so it's pretty effective in a degree of acidosis control too. But the main thing that we talked about here last night was using it as a delivery mechanism, a safe delivery mechanism for urea, in that, you know, when you're trying to utilise that, a lot of dry feed around the place, then urea blocks for mature animals that are already in good condition, it's a fantastic tool to enhance utilisation of dry feed and a very, as I said before, a very safe way of delivering it. But otherwise, the main reason for using salt blocks is to sell mineral preparation. And, you know, I hear all the time that, you know, oh, heavens, I've just bought these fantastic blocks and, you know, they're really high in copper and so that's just great. You know, the animals are boring into them, so they must be copper deficient. The first thing they'll always bore into is the salt. And whatever else is in there is kind of coincidental.
Right. Expand on that one. I'd heard about it years ago. I don't think we really see it much in practice in New Zealand. And you talked about, you know, supplementing with high quality fibre if we can when we're on an off-origin crop. But again, needs
if
must.
If you need to. If you need to, yeah.
But needs must, you know, if we're in a drought or something, sometimes we've got to feed poor quality. Hey, the use of salt and urea in the diet to help animals digest that. Do you want to expand a wee bit more about why you do that, what it does, and some specifics about how much, how you apply it, just the benefits you can see. Is it cost effective?
So, yeah, you tend to find, even though I think most of us have been brought up thinking that sheep and cattle are the same because they're ruminants, they're actually not, and there's a lot of evidence out there that they appear to digest their food quite differently. And cattle respond very well to urea, but you need to limit the percentage of their total diet to no more than 2%. But it's a very useful feedlot additive and as a source of protein. And those rumen bacteria are very clever in converting urea into amino acids and providing the animal with a high-quality source of protein. The results in sheep feedlots are not nearly as promising. They even mature sheep just don't seem to cope with or respond to urea as a replacement for high quality protein as well as cattle do. I don't know why, but also you need to limit sheep to no more than 1% of their diet.
So for cattle, it could be, you know, in a not an emergency situation, but an acute situation, I guess, a cost effective way of feeding them, rather than buying higher quality feed, to have a lower quality feed and apply some feeding some salt and urea.
Yeah, because the nutrient requirements of cattle per unit of body weight are actually a lot lower than they are for sheep. Sheep metabolically are far more cranked up and got much, much higher demand than cattle have. And so, you know, everybody would be well aware that, you know, cattle are very handy when you've got lots of dry feed that you need to use. But if you just put some urea blocks into the system for them, you will increase the efficiency at which they utilise that dry feed.
Yeah, you mentioned that salt stimulates intake. Salt always stimulates a lot of questions too, I've noticed.
So, oh, no.
Another one's going to salt help reduce clover bloat risk?
I suppose in theory it might, because it would, it definitely enhances the rate of passage. So in terms of, you know, the emptying rate of the rumen, it may help to some extent. It probably depends on how much salt the animal eats before it takes a few gulps of lucerne, doesn't it? How much salt's in there, what gets in there first. But are we talking sheep or cattle here? Do you know?
No, I didn't say either. So I was going to actually expand and talk about bloat in the respective species.
Yeah, so you want me to go on?
Yeah, by all means.
Okay, so definitely there's no doubt that cattle bloat on lucerne, and the main reason for that is because they can mow through it and eat such massive volumes in very quick time. And lucerne contains these nasty things called saponins, which cause the rumen fluid to froth up as if you were pouring detergent into a sink, and that just shuts off the outlet from the esophagus and they just blow up like a balloon. Sheep, on the other hand, they don't tend to eat the volume of feed that cattle do, and it is very, very, very unusual and unlikely that what you're seeing on Lucerne with sheep is bloat. It's more likely to be bloat secondary to Clostridia from enterotoxemia. So if you're not vaccinating with at least 3-in-1 vaccine, so a vaccine that contains an enterotoxemia preventative, then you certainly should be a month before you graze the Lucerne, and then if you're in there for more than a month, then they need to have another vaccination. It costs you 18 cents for the vaccination, and it's just nothing in terms of, you know, a dead animal. So think more about enterotox prevention rather than bloat when you're looking at Lucerne or sheep.
Had an email in from the question to say it was cattle he was asking about. So,
right.
But just on that point, you know, some of you are on the Lucerne text message service that Beef and Lamb New Zealand run.
Mm.
Consistently, one of the most common questions we get in after weed control is around stock and bloat, and lambs dying of bloat. And whenever we look at it, consistently it's clostridial and poor clostridial vaccine programs rather than, than bloat. It just looks the same when you find the dead animal.
So you've just got to be disciplined and say that if you're going to be grazing Lucerne, then they're going to have their two vaccines, and you know, it's just that simple, because you know, when clostridial bugs take over, it results in animals blowing up, so it's pretty understandable as to why you would think it was bloat. But the best prevention in cattle is to fill them up with fibre before they go in there, allow them to have access to a fibre source, and either spray some bloat oil on your pasture or put some oils, just some veggie oil, on the top of the water trough. Or alternatively, as unpalatable an idea as it might sound, the best bloat prevention in cattle is to actually mow it in front of them. Mow it the day before.
But it will.
Yep. And it stops the problem.
But we're going to just keep an eye on time and the questions we've got left to go. We want to pick Sam's brain a wee bit about containment feeding, which was one of the specialist topics we thought we'd get her out here to talk about, because we're all going to be feeding diets that were 80, 90, 100% of carry feed the way the year went. So we'll get onto that. But just before we get onto that, a follow-up question to some of the stuff earlier from somebody as advising farmers with a dairy cow. She uses the DMI, dry matter intake limitation, of 1.25 to 1.5% of body weight as NDF. Is there a similar rule of thumb for sheep, and I guess specifically using lambs?
No, and I'm not quite sure what the origins of that are, but what we can do is get... Are you going to post this somewhere or put it on a website or something?
Yeah,
I'll give you the NDF equation and you can put it up there. But anybody that's got pens poised, it's dry matter intake equals live weight multiplied by, open bracket, 120 divided by NDF, close bracket, percent. So that's the prediction equation, and I just encourage you to give it a whirl, because it's really useful, and it works pretty well as a predictor of intake.
Right. We'll flick that out in the email if we follow up, but that's for sheep and for cattle?
Yes.
Yeah. Positive speed. All right. Look, keep firing the questions in, and we'll try and address as many of them as we can. If we get some on a similar theme, we'll roll them together. But one that we talked a bit about last night, and that was part of the reason why I was keen to get Sam over here, if we'd seen some of this in South Australia, where obviously their dry period, their droughts are significantly more severe than we tend to see in New Zealand. But with our high stocking rates, we can have quite high impacts, obviously. Containment feeding is something that in your part of the world, farmers are getting pretty good at, where animals are in a paddock yard, shut up, 100% of their feed's dragged in. Maybe just to talk through some of the why they do that and some of the secrets to success, both in the facilities themselves, the physical facilities, and in the feeding of animals, and how cost-effective is it too, I guess.
Yes, it's the cost efficiency of it is an interesting question. But there's more to it, you know. I mean, how do you put a dollar value on your topsoil not blowing away? You know, there's things like that that make absolutely nailing the cost efficiency of it a little bit challenging. But really, containment areas are just built as feedlots. A lot of the stimulation of the development of containment areas has really been from 50% grants to farmers to stimulate them and entice them to pay up the other 50% and actually build it. And it's been driven by the Natural Resource Management Boards to try and get stock off paddocks over summer if there's no feed there. And the uptake has just, I think, bowled everybody over the last few years. These programs tend to roll in and then they roll out and then they roll back again. And there's been some, you know, pretty fantastic containment areas built. Basic rule of thumb for management is you've got to find the right area to put it on your property. It needs to have a gentle slope. You know, 1% to 2% slope's fine. But here I tend to see, you know, there's a fair bit of soil movement around the place. So think about your site. And just imagine that if you suddenly had, you know, 4 to 6 inch rain in a storm, where would everything end up? And think about that when you're building it. Build it across a slope and not down a slope so that when it rains, the muck from one pen's not running down into the next pen, etc. Make sure that you locate your water troughs on the bottom of the slope and your self-feeders, if that's what you're using, or your feed troughs at the top, so that, you know, they're not just walking from the feed trough to have a drink and then fouling the water, so that you're having to change the water trough every day. In terms of water, your water pressure is more important than the size of the water trough. The return rate of the water, they'll wait for it if the return rate's pretty quick. So think about one of the things I didn't mention last night is that don't set up containment areas such that you've got one self-feeder. So if the advantage guys say to you, you know, it's one feeder per 100 or 200 lambs, then don't set it up or use that you've just got one feeder there, because the bosses will rule it and, you know, you'll have a huge tail of shy feeders. So do your budgets to have at least two self-feeders per pen and 5 square metres per head is your space allowance. So we tend to run pens at around about 400 to 500 ewes, but there are also producers who just set up fence off areas on their property that aren't terribly productive, that might have some shade available, and they might just go off to clearing sales and buy up wholesale feeders, and, you know, they might have 10 feeders in there and, you know, 1,500 ewes. It doesn't really matter, provided they've got access to feed and water. We tend to put hay out ad lib, and sometimes that makes a bit of a mess, but nobody gets too worried about it because it's dry. And so, you know, over the next 12 months, there's usually sheep going through there being held for shearing, or, you know, it ends up being used, the area, for a lot of purposes that you would never have thought about until you build it. And eventually, you know, they will clean up whatever hay residues are in there, or else it just breaks down. But that would probably need to be a consideration here, where it's wetter, and you may need to think about, you know, using weld mesh racks or hay racks to keep your hay off the ground rather than just putting it on the ground.
So we're probably talking about some things here that are relatively uncommon in New Zealand. You're feeding under probably quite severe duress, you know, in terms of environmental. But we've talked about the sheep industry in New Zealand moving on to higher and drier countries, which tend to lose better or wetter country to dairy industry, dairy support, intensification on that country, still get higher lambing percentages, want to finish lambs and so on. So the risk of some of these events has tended to increase. And a couple of years ago, we saw parts of New Zealand having to feed grain and so on that had never done so before. You know, and the predictions are true. We're going to see more in events like that. So I want to touch a wee bit on grain feeding. Parts of New Zealand know it reasonably well, but it's probably not as well known here as in your part of the world. Is it, and I guess this might be a tricky one for you to answer, but is there anything cheaper than good grain as a bought-in feed? have on farm?
It very much depends on what you're looking for. So you're looking for, you know, are you looking for energy or you're looking for protein? So if we're talking young sheep, you're generally looking for moderately high levels of both. If we're talking about mature sheep, then you're looking at, you know, dry sheep, moderate levels, you know, 8% protein, 8 ME. For merinos, that protein level needs to go up to 10, otherwise you won't optimise wool growth. So you're looking at, you know, fairly low demand. So the place to start is, what are you looking for? So if you've got ewes that are early pregnancy, for example, and the place is dry and you need to get them off the paddocks and contain them, then if you've made good quality hay, the chances are that that hay will meet their requirements, so you don't need any grain. If hay is in short supply or the quality of it's below requirements, then that's how we would put a ration together. We would always start with the roughage, and then we would build the grain requirement on top of that. Yeah.
With grain feeding, and a couple of questions around that have come in, how much grain is too much? I think this question came out of having observed or heard tales of Australian farmers feeding some extremely high amounts of grain, particularly to sheep.
Mm.
How much do you get up to? What's the level?
Well, if you put lambs in a feedlot to finish them, and you put out ad-lib hay and ad-lib access to grain, they, by choice, will generally eat about 75% grain and 25% hay. And the lower the quality of the hay, the more that hay consumption will go down and grain consumption will go up. And once you've adapted the rumen bacteria to grain, you can feed them 100% grain. And there are lamb feedlots who do that. I'm not an advocate, though, and I want to get that out there in big letters. I'm not an advocate of feeding 100% grain because ruminants are basically roughage-based animals, and, you know, that's how I like to keep them. But, you know, in droughts in years gone by where those droughts have been so prolonged and so severe, I mean, we've had breeding flocks being contained and fed on wheat alone. So provided the rumen's adaptive and provided you're giving them access calcium and salt, you can feed them 100% grain. So it's not a problem.
So their role,
but I'm not saying do it.
If, and hypothetically then, what's the role of salt and calcium in the diet? It's just because they're very deficient in that.
Wheat is very deficient in sodium. So whenever you're feeding wheat or grazing green wheat, you should always be putting some additional salt on offer. If you're trying to feed calcium in the form of stock lime, it's just like eating talcum powder, and so we always tend to do a mix of 80% lime, 20% salt. The salt there is an intake stimulator for the lime rather than for any other reason, because all your cereal grains are really low in calcium. And particularly, we normally, in the most common class of sheep that we would have in containment is ewes in late pregnancy. And so, you know, their demand for calcium at that time is escalating. So, you know, it's pretty important to have that lime in the diet.
All right, just keeping an eye on time, and we'll keep moving through. Feel free, if you've got more questions, fire them in. The next one is, in your experience, and I guess, and also looking at what you've seen here in New Zealand, is there any situation where grain feeding economically would make more sense than feeding pasture, forage brassicas, fodder beet, things you can actually grow on farm yourself?
No. Absolutely not. If you've got the rainfall to grow high quality feed, then that's what you should do. We don't have to be so fussy about it because we've got ready access to grain and, you know, it's often relatively cheap. A lot of our farmers are mixed farmers and, you know, they will always have seconds grain, you know, in a wheat crop, the barley might have come up from previous years, and so its cash value drops. You know, they've got pinch grain when the season shut off early, so there's always a lot of seconds grain around. So that, in combination with our exceptionally dodgy springs, means that for us, if we haven't got irrigation, that fodder crops are pretty high risk. I mean, even in, you know, southwestern Victoria, where there's a lot of fodder crops going in spring, you know, they'll have years where they just don't do anything. They don't eventuate. So if you can grow fodder crops pretty much, you know, 9 years out of 10, I would not be replacing that with grain.
All right, just, I mean, it's been a bit of a flying visit for you. We've been trying to extract every ounce of work out of you we can for your money. The levy payers out there will be happy to know. But, you know, I realise it's the first time you had a really good chance to have a look around on some New Zealand farms. But in what you've seen so far, is there anything you're surprised you didn't see or any opportunities you've seen? I know it's, you know, you're reluctant to make too many big calls until you get more familiar with some of the places. But what have you seen or what have you thought of from over home that would think it's an opportunity for sheep and beef farms here in New Zealand?
I think the biggest opportunity is to get a better handle on what the quality of the feed is around the place. I think that's an imperative. And don't worry, that's not just New Zealand farmers. I've probably spent 20 years banging on to our farmers about doing feed tests. But, you know, I have to say, I think they're just starting to get it. So, you know, the Kiwis can jump on board and just get into it. And I think those guys on Tuesday, after having spent that day in the paddock, looking at the pasture and looking at the feed test, like, they got it. They seriously got it. And they were all fired up to go home and start doing some testing and finding out what they're dealing with. And the other thing I think you need to be really careful of is the absolute explosion in people that are now trying to sell products into the sheep industry, particularly mineral preparations, such that if you start doing some testing and getting very good information about what mineral deficiencies you have or haven't got on your property, then when people try and tell you that you need these things, you'll be in a very, very good position to know whether that's the case or not. So I think that's probably the main message from me, is get tested, because then you're in control. Then you can make right decisions.
I think it's a saying in your part of the world, Sydney one here, if you don't measure it, you can't manage it.
That's right.
One, just on that, one specific thing, I actually made a note of it last night that you did talk about was, I'll get the term right, extending cereal crops, sowing them in autumn, and then using them as we'd call them standing hay or something like that, a saved forage. Do you want to talk us through how that works and it may be something that could be an opportunity here?
Yeah, it might be. Well, particularly, you know, if dry springs and shutoffs and things like that are something that that you're facing. I sincerely hope you're not. But if you are, then what we've got a lot of our clients doing now is sowing cereal crops around the autumn break. Some people sow dry. Depends a bit on soil type. And then if you get significant amounts of rain and you've got loads of dry matter in the winter, then doing a winter graze. But if you're in a drier, lower rainfall area, then that tends to be high risk. And so it's just sown at the break of the season and then it's locked up. And then we're weaning lambs onto it in November once it starts to ripen. And well, some people are going in there in November, in October. It just depends on your season. And wheat crops in particular, the ewes and lambs need to go in as it starts to ripen. Don't wait till it's ripe. And just let it ripen in front of them. And then you won't get any acidosis. And one of the things that we're seeing is a huge benefit is reduction in labour cost of feeding. And just the tons of dry matter that you can grow and how cheap it is in terms of finishing lambs. Once they've knocked all the heads off, you will need to start supplementing with protein so they can utilise the straw or turn them out and, you know, bring in another class of sheep or cattle to clean it up. The other thing we do is, because it's a ripe crop, as they walk through it grazing, they tend to be dropping grain all over the ground. And so often we will then use it as a two-year option. So at the break of the season the following year, you get very, very rapid germination because the soil temperature is still up. And so we will go into it and use it up for lambing ewes in year two and then possibly spray it out, you know, at the end of that year and continue on with whatever the rotation is. The only thing you have to be careful of is if you have fairly reliable wettish summers, there are some varieties of dry cereal that do not like that at all. And we've had a pretty horrible experience with Winteroo oats, which is a very commonly grown export hay oat, in that we got about 4 inches of rain a few years ago in January, and this whole paddock of standing crop just turned into a rotten, stinking mess. So, you know, it's horses for courses.
It rained, so it probably wasn't such a big issue. So.
No.
Any particular, so is wheat the best option? Or
You'll tend to find that wheat will give you the highest protein, so you'll get the best growth rates, and, you know, you'll have to do the least amount of supplementation. On oats, you'll need to be supplementing with a protein source, which, you know, here might be your palm kernel, or it might be, you know, peas, so some sort of a protein source. Barley or trip, well, they can be anywhere in between. So you really need to just strip some grain off, send it off for a test, and then you know what you're dealing with.
And you'll probably start this answer with, it depends, again. But what sort of live weight gains are you getting? I mean, I guess it's going to stocking rate per hectare, but particularly per head live weight gain on that sort of problem.
Yeah, the stocking rate per hectare varies from district to district, but as a general rule of thumb, in our sort of 350 to 450 mil rainfall, or probably 350 to 500 mil rainfall zones, where sowing rates are lower, we would generally be looking at 15 to 20 lambs per hectare. And in the higher rainfall zones, we'd be looking at 30 lambs per hectare.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that varies a bit with soil type too.
Mobbed up, strip grazed across.
No, we don't strip graze once it's dry. Yeah.
Just sit stock, let them go.
Yep, we just mow a track around the outside so they can find their way to the water trough.
Yep.
And we let them work their way through it. Yeah. It's all terribly alarming. You can't see them. Mm-hmm. But eventually you see them.
Yeah, birds out of there.
And it's all good. Yeah.
So when you're talking about a break, and that's typically around about Anzac Day, you're getting a rain. So it's just
that's word across.
So we're talking autumn sown cereals, let them go through to weaning.
Yeah.
So November, those lambs would have been born when you lamb.
Oh, well, we tend to have lambs in all the time, actually, autumn.
But just
but those lambs
have it ready for wean.
The purpose that these are more sown for is our July lambers that are November weaning, when all of our pastures have gone to rubbish. Yeah.
But it could conceivably work quite well, September lambing in New Zealand.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it would work. Sure, yeah.
All right. Look, we just I made note of that one last night because I thought it was just something I'm not aware of happening much in New Zealand, but I could see it working quite well. There's no reason why it wouldn't work in some of our drier environments as an alternative means of having lamb feed ready at weaning time.
The big advantage of it is that, you know, you're growing it on winter rainfall, which is in theory more likely to come than spring rainfall, it seems, at the moment. And so, you know, if you're having problems with the reliability of fodder crop, then it's something to consider.
All right. Hey, look, we're coming up to the half hour, which is when I said we'd wrap up. So I've got the same question I finished with last night for Sam. We can't let it go without it. So what are you taking home to tell your farmers that you've seen here that impresses you?
Green. It's absolute heaven. Yep, it's as dry as a chip at home, two failed springs and very, very dry and lots of burnt ground. So that's the biggest thing I'm taking home with me is green and your hospitality. And your fantastic looking lambs, and certainly up north, I've seen some magnificent looking sheep. But the ewes are in tremendous condition, some wonderful fodder crops.
Keep making it rain. You can come back any time, Sam.
Mm.
Hey, look, it's now ticked over to 8:30. Thanks for all the questions that came in. I had to amalgamate a few together, and hopefully got the theme or the tone of what you're after out. And there were a couple of things we discussed around the table or on the conference call last night I made note of to bring up tonight that I thought would be of interest. But many thanks for tuning in to the this conference call. It's brought to you by the Red Meat Profit Partnership. And we've recorded the call. I've got your email addresses. I'll send out the link to you as soon as we get it up on YouTube if you want to go back through and listen to any bits. And we'll follow that up with an email with links to some of the information Sam mentioned and that equation, which I wrote down very precisely, and I'll get it a check. So look, thanks very much, Sam, for coming over and joining us for the call tonight. Thank you to all of you out there who are listening, and good night. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.